If you love Something Was Wrong and want to help support the show, become a community contributor on Apple Podcasts or purchase a sticker from our sticker shop at BrokenCycleMedia.com. Thank you so much. Something Was Wrong is intended for mature audiences and includes topics that may be upsetting. This season, we'll be discussing friendship betrayal, religious abuse, stalking, sexual assault, and other serious topics. So please listen with care. Some names have been changed for safety or anonymity purposes. The podcast and any linked materials should not be misconstrued as a substitution for legal or medical advice. Sources and resources can be found in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Last time on Something Was Wrong.
I felt so validated by the court and by these 12 jurors. The verdict was March 2025. The sentencing was October, the month before the sentencing hearing. I had texted the victim's advocate and I'd sent letters of support. I didn't want the defense to have my victim impact statement before the sentencing hearing. The prosecutor said, "So you're going to testify today?" I said, "Do you mean read my victim impact statement?" And he said, "Yes." I think I was up there for like 3 minutes. It seemed like a very short time. As I'm answering, I was thinking, I'll still read my victim impact statement. It's been prepared ahead of time, and it's going to be a lot more effective in a situation like this where I'm so nervous. And that didn't happen. As soon as the judge shared the sentencing, I felt a tapping on my back. The court victim advocate was like, "We gotta go." And we were rushing out of the courtroom, even though everybody was still there and the judge was still talking. Finally, he's like, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Why didn't I read my victim impact statement?" He said, "You did." And I said, "No, I didn't." When I got home, I stood there by my front door. And I just said, "There's no way that this just happened." And it made me extremely concerned for other victims. I'm like, how have they been treated? How are they going to be treated after me? This is the justice system. We're not dealing with a church. We're not dealing with a university. We're dealing with an actual legal process. Hopelessness really came over me. This thought gently comes into my head. That wasn't the only way to share it, my victim impact statement. So then I decide to videotape myself reading my victim impact statement, and I shared it to Facebook. This is my victim impact statement. My name is Marie Kalumna, and I'm the victim in the case against Sergio Guardia, who has been convicted of stalking and breaking into my home on two separate occasions. No written statement can capture the full weight of what Sergio has done. My trial testimony offered only a glimpse of the abuse I endured, psychological, emotional, and spiritual. The harm continues not only from his actions, but from the deliberate protection he has received from Thomas Road Baptist Church. For years, Sergio used his position of power and spiritual authority to psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually abuse me. He harassed me, monitored me, my activities, stalked me, assaulted me, and ultimately broke into my home on multiple occasions. Sergio displayed a consistent pattern of manipulation and exploitation. He weaponized my past trauma. He saw it as opportunity to exploit. And he did so while cloaked in religious authority, which made his abuse even more damaging. He weaponized my trust, violated my privacy, and ignored every boundary that I set. To him, my boundaries were not no's. They were challenges to overcome. He used church networks, mutual connections, and his pastoral role to entangle himself deeper into my life. What appeared to be generosity or ministry was in fact a calculated pattern of coercive control and spiritual exploitation. These were not isolated incidents. His actions were a part of a much larger pattern of coercive control and abuse enabled by systems within the church that has protected him.
In my attempt to feel safe, I moved multiple times, but no matter where I went, Sergio's obsession followed me. When I discovered him inside my home in November 2023, several years after last seeing him, I realized that his behavior had escalated beyond stalking into direct physical danger. I recognized that my kids and I were, in fact, in very real danger. Both nights that he broke in, he entered through my 16-year-old daughter's bedroom. On the second night, video evidence shows that he was in her room for nearly 10 minutes. He never went upstairs. It chills me to my core to imagine what could have happened if we had been home, or if I had not discovered the footage. His actions crossed every possible line. He was not only violating my safety, he was invading and violating my daughter's safety. Sergio's crimes shattered our sense of peace and safety. I live with PTSD and have experienced both anxiety and depression. I constantly checked my home for hidden cameras. I struggled to sleep, to focus at work, and to be fully present for my children. The financial strain has been significant with therapy costs, lost wages from court preparations and appearances, and the mental toll of ongoing trauma. The impact on my children, especially my daughter, has been devastating. He broke into her bedroom, her safe space, her childhood sanctuary. That room had been a safe space, a place for constant sleepovers and core childhood memories. Our house was the go-to spot for all the kids and friends. It was always full of life and energy because of them. As a single mother, my ability to provide stability was compromised, and I still wonder if her friends were ever truly safe in our home, and that question haunts me. The harm did not end with Sergio's conviction. Thomas Road Baptist Church, the institution he served, has continued to protect and defend him. Instead of standing with victims, they chose silence, distortion, and public sympathy for the offender. After his conviction made national news, the church used its platform to portray him as a victim, misleading the congregation and diminishing the seriousness of his crimes. Their actions emboldened abusers and re-traumatized survivors. This is not only about one man's behavior, it's about a system that allowed abuse to thrive under the cover of faith. Sergio has never shown any remorse. Any. Instead, he has reframed his crimes as injustices against himself, manipulated those around him, and continued to seek control through sympathy and denial. A man who refuses to take responsibility does not stop, he adapts. He finds new ways to exert control and reestablish power. That makes him a continuing danger, not only to me and my children, but to any person he can influence or deceive in the future. I know there will be letters and testimonies describing Sergio as a loving husband, father, and pastor. His supporters will describe him as a man of God that did good deeds and incredible work in the ministry. They do not change the facts established in this court. The character descriptions do not erase his pattern of abuse, the crimes he has committed, and the harm done to me and my children and other victims. I recognize that Sergio's wife may feel pain and fear as her husband faces sentencing. I empathize with any spouse in that situation, but sentencing is not about minimizing discomfort for the offender's family. It's about justice, accountability, and public safety. Sentencing must reflect the ongoing danger he poses, not the convenience of sparing his family the consequences. I trust that your decision will be based on truth of what was done and not on selective stories told by people who did not live through the danger, the fear, and the impact of these crimes. I also want to emphasize that Sergio's behavior toward me over the past 10 years was intentional and calculated, not a misunderstanding. This was a pattern of grooming, control, and escalation. He groomed me through helpful favors. He isolated me by discrediting my friends. He tested and violated my boundaries, escalating into sexual assault, stalking, and home invasion. He gaslit me into silence and confusion, and he used his position as a pastor to spiritually and emotionally abuse me in an attempt to destroy my identity and gain control of me. Sergio's actions represent a clear and ongoing danger to others. He has shown no remorse and continues to manipulate those around him. The ongoing involvement of third parties who have continued to monitor and intimidate me on his behalf demonstrate that threat to my safety has not ended, even after his conviction. Your Honor, I respectfully ask the court to impose the maximum sentence allowed by law, reflecting the deliberate, escalating, and predatory nature of these crimes, to extend the protective order to the maximum duration allowed by law to ensure long-term safety for me and my children, given the ongoing risk and history of escalation, to prohibit him as part of sentencing and supervision from serving in any pastoral counseling or leadership capacity that grants him authority or access to vulnerable individuals in order to ensure public safety and prevent future abuse, and to require post-release supervision with active monitoring. By holding Sergio fully accountable, this court will send a clear and necessary message. Abuse committed under the cover of religion will not be tolerated, not in our homes, not in our churches, and not in our communities. Sergio sought to shatter my safety, destroy my credibility, and take control of my life. He failed, but the damage he caused is lasting and deep. I speak today not only for myself, but for every survivor who has been silenced, dismissed, and discredited, especially when their abusers were protected by their position of authority. I ask this court to look beyond personal endorsements and to focus on the truth, the evidence, and the lasting impact of these crimes. Thank you, Your Honor, for hearing my voice. Sincerely, me. Thanks for listening. Every victim deserves to be heard.
I shared it, and it really took me by surprise that so many people were actually interested in it. I thought maybe a couple people might listen to it. It turned out to be thousands of people that listened to it, that commented, that shared it, because I posted it publicly. Many people I don't even know, or I'm not even connected on social media, commented or shared. That was so surprising to me. I was so glad that I thought to do that because people were so incredibly supportive.
It sounds like it restored your faith a little bit in humanity.
It absolutely did.
I'd like to thank Quince for sponsoring today's episode. The best summer pieces are the ones you end up wearing on repeat. Comfortable, versatile, and somehow right for almost every occasion. That's why I love Quince. They make elevated essentials using premium materials like European linen, organic cotton, and washable silk, without the traditional retail markup. Quince's 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops are the pieces you'll reach for all summer long. I was in need of a new pair of everyday leggings, and I got their Ultraform high-rise pocket leggings, and I love them. And it's not just apparel. Quince also offers elevated essentials for your home, from bedding to bath, to kitchen essentials and furniture, to beauty and candles. I love the candles. Make your summer wardrobe feel easier. Go to quince.com/SWW for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/SWW for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/SWW. Thank you so much. I'm excited to share our latest sponsor, Lola Blankets. As I mentioned in one of our bonus episodes recently, one of my absolute favorite things right now is my Lola blanket that ABC got me for my birthday. It is the softest blanket I've ever had. It has ultra soft luxury faux fur and a signature four-way stretch that really sets it apart. Lola has over 20,000 five-star reviews, and once you feel it, you will know why. It's the reason it's called the world's number one blanket. This thing is next level. For a limited time, our listeners can get 40% off Lola Blankets products with code SWW at checkout. Just head to lolablankets.com and use SWW to get 40% off your order. That's lolablankets.com. Use code SWW to get 40% off your order. Thank you so much.
A woman from the victim's notification system had contacted me. It turns out I think I was supposed to wait for him to actually be sentenced to register for the notifications. So she had called me because she got my request. She had left a voice message asking that I call her back because she got my request, but she just wanted some more information. So I had called her back and she was like, I can't find him in the system. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. The sentencing was actually today and he was sentenced. She was like, okay, great. Now you'll be registered and get the notifications. She mentioned she was actually off work that day, but because she got my message, she decided to call me back. If that's not support, I don't know what is. Then I told her what happened in court. And I said, is there any other support I can get? And she had a contact at the attorney general's office, and she highly recommended that I get in contact with her. So I emailed them and I gave a summary of what I've been through. I told them that it was too late to submit my victim impact statement into the record. And they said, no, it's not. Just send it to us. We'll submit it in the record. And so they got in contact with the clerk's office in Lynchburg, and they submitted my records and then gave me confirmation that my victim impact statement was in the records. I felt so validated and valued. And that's one thing I have rarely felt by the church. Well, I haven't felt valued by the church at all. I didn't feel valued in court, really. And I didn't even feel valued with the group of supporters that came around me. So feeling valued was huge. I didn't know until a few days after sentencing hearing that he had the week to be with his family and then turn himself in. I didn't know because I was taken out of the sentencing hearing by the victim's advocate, which is crazy that I found out from somebody else later, because right after a sentencing hearing, when criminals convicted of crimes like stalking and breaking, entering and assault, especially when he is sentenced to jail, is a critical time where a victim could be in even more danger because of retaliation. What kind of advocacy is this that I wouldn't be notified and prepared for something that affects my safety? But again, that's another pattern.
During those 4 months when he was incarcerated, did it have an impact on your sense of safety?
I wish I would have felt safer, but I didn't. I was really worried about retaliation, which it's always in the back of my mind when I share things publicly. When I finally knew that he was in jail, I didn't feel safer because he's not my only threat. After my story made national news after the conviction, Jonathan Falwell made a statement to the congregation.
Back in 2023, I think it was in November of 2023, one of our staff members who served in our Spanish ministry was arrested. It happened, I think, on a Saturday night. And on Sunday morning, I was sitting in my office about 6:30, 7 o'clock that morning, and I got a text from Matt Wilmington, who had gotten a text that, from someone who saw it in the news online, I guess on social media, and sent him a story about what happened with this individual who served on our staff that he'd been arrested the night before. I found out about it right before I came to preach. We didn't have any details. We didn't know the situation. We didn't know anything that was going on. But that afternoon, I met with the deacons, and I shared with them that we had a staff member who was arrested for stalking and burglary or breaking and entering. And that we'd seen that only in the news, the only information we had that came from that story. So I shared it with the deacons that day, and I told the deacons that afternoon, that Sunday afternoon, that the next day, when our team had the opportunity of meeting with him, that certainly his position would be terminated immediately. But what would not terminate is that we as a church would continue to minister to him and to his family and to the other parties, the victim. We would minister to all of them because that's what a church is supposed to do. And so that the next afternoon, or maybe two afternoons later, when he was actually released from jail, one of our pastors went and met with him and shared with him in that moment that your job ends now. You know, you're no longer employed by Thomas Road, but certainly we want to do what we can to minister to you, to minister to your family. It's a tragic situation. What really it is just, it was a stupid decision made by a human. In other words, it was just sin is all there was. And sin breaks everything that it touches. And so that's what happened that afternoon. So his job was terminated. A few days after that, one of our pastors talked with the victim in the situation, the other party in the situation, and offered to her our prayers, number one, offered to her assistance, any assistance that we could give, offered counseling if she so chose to take advantage of that at no charge. And she made it very clear, like, if I need something, if I need, you know, I'll certainly reach out. I know how to do that. I'll give you guys a call. And so that's what took place in those days that following that situation. The following Sunday, after, of course, all the news had come out, all the story of all the details that was taking place, we went into our Spanish congregation. And Luis Nadal and Matt Wilmington and our Spanish pastors sung. All three of them stood before the Spanish congregation and shared with them. Of course, they all already knew because it had been in the newspaper, but still, they shared with them at that point what we knew, because all we knew came from the media. Now, in the last year and, 5 months or so, I've not spoken about this issue in this room or anywhere. There's a reason for that. I've not spoken about it, and no one on our team has spoken about it, because it was an ongoing legal case. And in an ongoing legal case, not even police officers will speak to it. Not the attorneys will speak to it. Because obviously, there's ramifications for everything that you say on every level. Last week, it went to trial. It was adjudicated. He was found guilty on all charges. And so today, I'm able to stand up and share with you what we did all through this journey, what we've done all through this whole situation, which has been a tragic situation. And by the way, understand that in a situation like this, no one wins. So the family doesn't win. That staff member who's now been convicted, he doesn't win. The other party, the victim, the lady, she doesn't win. The church doesn't win. And ultimately, the body of Christ doesn't win.
Right.
And that's what sin does. When sin comes in, it doesn't just affect one person. It affects all of us. And so that's where we are. Now, I will say this, and I will say this clearly to you. Everything that we have done from the moment that we found out about it, that Sunday of 2023, everything that we have done with one purpose in mind, to make sure we act with integrity and that we do things biblically. When our staff member talked with the victim in this situation on that first phone call days after it took place, it was shared with her that we certainly love him, that our staff member who was arrested, we love him, we're praying for him, and it breaks our heart what happened. But we love God and his word more, and he shared with her. Make sure that you cooperate fully with the police. Make sure you tell them everything they need to know. Why? Because it is more important that we do things biblically and with integrity than it is to try to hide things. We're not going to hide anything. We have acted with integrity. We've acted biblically. We've done everything we possibly could with the information we had and the timing that we had. We've done everything we can to honor Christ through all of this, even as difficult as this is. And I will say this. And this church and our staff, we will always act biblically, and we will always respond in every situation, no matter how tragic it might be, to try to reflect the love of Christ first, but also to reflect the integrity that Christ expects from us as followers of Christ, and certainly leaders in the church, that we want to make sure we act with integrity in every situation. And I make that commitment to you. That is how we will always respond. It is how we will always act. It is what we will always do. Because we do not represent Thomas Road Baptist Church. We represent Christ. And that's how we're going to serve, and that's what we're going to do. And so it's a tragic situation. Our hearts break. Coming up in August, I think it is, the sentence date. There's a family that is still walking through some of the most difficult storms that you could possibly imagine. We need to continue to pray for them. There are some that might suggest that because of what he has done, that the church should turn our back on them. And I would say to you that that is exactly opposite of what God's word tells us to do. We're not going to turn our back. We're going to continue to pray for them. We're going to continue to minister to them. Certainly he's not going to work here. And certainly we're not going to stand up and fight for him. Listen, he made a stupid mistake, and it's sin. And sin has consequence, absolutely. But man, we're still going to love him. We're going to love the other party. We're going to continue to minister to her as best we can. We're going to do all that we can to provide whatever assistance we can provide. And that's what the church ought to do. And so I want to share that with you. And last, finally, what I would say to you is this, is that if there's any questions, you know, there's a reason why I stand down here every Sunday after church. It's the reason why if you ever call my office to say, I'd love to meet, the answer is always yes. There's a reason why I try to be available, even though it's a large church, is to make sure you always recognize and understand that as pastor here, as the shepherd here, like, hey, I'm accessible. And if you need me, if you have a question, or listen, and this is key, or if there's other concerns that I don't even know about, man, I want to hear about it. Kind of that old New York, you know, city police statement. If you see something, say something, right? Why? Because we have a responsibility to reflect the word of God, the gospel of Christ, the church of Christ, and we want to make sure we do it with integrity, and we want to make sure we do it biblically.
The following audio is part of a sermon that Executive Pastor Matt Wilmington gave to Thomas Road Church on October 26, 2025, 8 days after Sergio's sentencing.
I have a friend this morning who woke up actually, literally, in jail. A dear friend of mine and he's in prison. And I love him. And God's doing a beautiful, deep work in his life. And he's praying for God, Lord, I'm in the dark night of my soul and my family. Will you do something? Listen, Peter, yes, he will. If you are being hunted by the enemy today, and you feel like you're in your dark night, heaven will show up and God will deliver. Amen?
Since Thomas Road Baptist Church's inception in 1956 and Liberty University's in 1971, both institutions and their founding family have long been the subject of focus and scrutiny in the media. Just 2 years after Liberty University was founded, the Securities and Exchange Commission sued Falwell's church for fraud and deceit in connection with the issuance of $6.5 million in uninsured bonds. A 1981 article by The New Yorker shared that, quote, in court, the judge absolved the church of intentional wrongdoing, and the SEC lawyers dropped the words fraud and deceit from their complaint in 1973. However, an NPR article reported that, the same year the suit was dropped, quote, Liberty University filed for bankruptcy and reorganized, losing millions in church investors, end quote. In 2001, Jerry Falwell continued to face media scrutiny when he made inflammatory statements on the 700 Club television broadcast 2 days after the September 11th attacks. CBS News reported that Falwell said, quote, God had allowed terrorists to attack America because of the work of civil liberties groups, abortion rights supporters, and feminists, end quote. An apology was issued on his behalf within days, but the words had already been spoken. Not long after, Jerry Falwell passed away in 2007. His son, Jerry Falwell Jr., consequently took over as president and chancellor of Liberty University. In 2020, Jerry Falwell Jr.'s personal scandals and alleged misconduct were revealed and then highlighted in the 2022 documentary, God Forbid, the sex scandal that brought down a dynasty. The controversy centered on allegations involving an extramarital relationship between Falwell Jr., his wife Becky Falwell, and a former business associate, Giancarlo Granda. The documentary also raised concerns about Falwell Jr.'s use of university resources and governance practices. The scandal caused an immense amount of national media coverage, as Falwell Jr. had long served as one of the most visible leaders of evangelical higher education and a prominent political ally of President Donald Trump. As public pressure mounted and Liberty University faced growing concerns about institutional credibility, Falwell Jr. formally resigned as president in August 2020. As a result, Falwell Jr. openly agreed to take an indefinite leave of absence from Liberty University. However, he was still allowed to remain available for consultation with leadership before he ultimately resigned. Rather than turning to outside leadership to fill the role, Liberty elevated longtime insider and board chairman Jerry Privo to acting president, ensuring continuity within the same inner circle. Not long afterward, Jonathan Falwell, son of founder Jerry Falwell Sr. and brother of Jerry Falwell Jr., was elevated to the role of university chancellor, reinforcing the continued leadership of the Falwell family within the institution, despite public claims of reform. According to a March 2024 Associated Press article, media concerns intensified after federal investigators fined Liberty University a record $14 million in 2024 for Clery Act violations tied to the mishandling and underreporting of campus crime and sexual violence allegations. The Clery Act is a law that requires colleges and universities that receive federal funding to collect data on campus crime and notify students of threats. Liberty University's fine remains to be the largest ever levied under the Clery Act. Amidst investigations, former Liberty University students and whistleblowers described a culture in which administrators allegedly discouraged reporting and prioritized the university's public image. The 2024 Associated Press article goes on to state, quote,
Liberty has marketed itself for years as having one of the nation's safest campuses, with more than 15,000 students enrolled at the school. But its police department had a single officer with minimal oversight for investigating crimes during most of the time period reviewed by federal investigators from 2016 to 2023. The U.S. Department of Education said it identified numerous cases that resulted in the misclassification or underreporting of crimes. And there were several incidents that the university determined to be unfounded without evidence the initial report was false, end quote. This continued pattern paints the image of institutions more committed to preserving its internal power structure than demanding meaningful accountability. I'd like to thank Poshmark for sponsoring today's episode. When I first heard about Poshmark, I had no idea that they had such an incredible vintage selection. One of the first pieces I ever bought on there was this amazing 80s vintage skirt. Poshmark is the leading fashion resale marketplace shaped by real people and real style. Millions of new and pre-loved items, from daily wardrobe staples to vintage and luxury fashion. Archive-worthy pieces you thought you missed forever. Current essentials, one-of-one vintage finds, it's all there. And when you're ready for a closet refresh, you can earn real money selling the pieces you're ready to part with, reaching over 80 million users on the platform. I was looking for a vintage Coach bag for a gift for someone, and I was able to find it on the app within minutes. New deals and styles are listed every day, so don't wait. Download the Poshmark app today and use code SWW when you sign up to get $10 off your first purchase. Thank you so much. When we first connected for your pre-interview, I believe he had either just gotten out of jail or was just about to get out of jail. And then about a week after we connected, you had reached out and let us know that you had suffered another tragic loss. Do you mind sharing a little bit about what happened with the listeners?
Yeah. Sunday, Sergio got out of jail. I think they're released at 5 or 6 a.m. And then exactly 1 week later at 4 a.m., my kids and I were asleep in my house and I heard a loud crash. It woke me up from a deep sleep. So I wasn't thinking clearly and I just blamed Luna, my Great Pyrenees. Anytime a dish breaks or something, it's always her. But this was 4 o'clock in the morning, which makes no logical sense because she will not wake up in the middle of the night. I was like, oh, I'll just think about it in the morning. As I was going back to sleep, I smelled a very, very intense, horrible, horrible smell. It smelled like maybe plastic was burning. I jumped out of bed and ran downstairs thinking maybe I could solve whatever was happening. And by the time I got to the bottom of the stairs, I saw my kitchen engulfed in flames, the biggest flames I've ever seen. And in that moment, I just thought, we need to get out. This is life or death. None of the smoke detectors went off, which is very alarming, no pun intended. And I just started screaming for my kids. At the bottom of the stairs is the front door. So I was right by the front door. The fire was just so big, I was afraid to go upstairs. I didn't know where the fire was going. So I started screaming for my kids, but I quickly couldn't breathe. The smoke was just overwhelming. So I opened the door so I could catch my breath. And I remember being so terrified because I couldn't catch my breath and I was trying to do it quickly because I had to keep screaming for my kids. It took so long just to catch my breath. And then I would step back inside and scream at the top of my lungs. And I was screaming for my two dogs and they didn't bark or anything. They weren't coming to me. I didn't know where they were. Luna's usually right in front of my door. And she wasn't there when I ran downstairs. So I was confused because once she lays down, she doesn't really move. A couple times I had to go outside, catch my breath, and then step back in and scream. And I finally heard my daughter say, where? And I could tell she was right near me, but we couldn't see each other. She was at the bottom of the stairs. We were probably 2 feet away from each other. I couldn't see anything, but I saw a light through the smoke. And it was my son's flashlight on his phone. Thankfully, they remembered their phones because I didn't. I just reached in and grabbed one of them. Was there sure one was their arm? And I just pulled them. I said, here. My daughter called 911. Finally, Luna, my Great Pyrenees, comes prancing up to the door. I just couldn't go inside anymore. But once she went up to the door and I saw her, I was able to pull her out. And then my other dog, I was grieving because I'm like, we lost him. There's no way I could go back in. And the fire department got there within 5 minutes. A firefighter rescued my dog, Aussie. So I was so happy about that. This was January 18th. I had shorts, t-shirt, no socks. And this is Virginia. So it was cold, but I didn't feel cold. And my kids were smart. They put on pants and shoes. My next door neighbor saw us outside and had us come into his house, and his wife fed us breakfast. I was so, so thankful that they let us into their home and they gave us money, and she helped me find an Airbnb. The firefighters kept coming over to the neighbor's house asking questions. They'd taken pictures of the kitchen to identify like what was on the counter. The whole reason I had the batteries on the counter is because I felt like I needed to get more batteries for the Ring cameras.
So you would have the backups.
Yes, I needed to get ones that were cheap. So I got this one from Amazon, which is probably the one
that the fire people said that probably caused it.
Yep, because it was already swelling, but I didn't know anything.
It's just strange that the Ring camera, the same thing that basically helped convict him, is also the same thing that potentially caused the house fire.
Tiffany, do you know I never even considered that? I'm going to be processing this all night. I really appreciate that you shared that observation.
I just found it so odd.
I have thought over and over again, why were there no batteries in any of the alarms? That is so bizarre to me. I know I've changed them. And it's not like they weren't working. There were no batteries.
Why wouldn't there be dead batteries?
Right. A firefighter took us back in our house and we walked through to get the stuff that we absolutely needed, but he told us we couldn't take anything that touched our skin, hair, no hygiene products, like nothing. And then I was like, there's really nothing for me to take. On the side yard was all of this mail and stuff just strewn on the yard, because when the firefighters were in my kitchen, they used the hose. Things were flown out of the kitchen window. I found like a baked potato on my yard because it had baked in the fire. All these random fruits and vegetables and pieces of mail because I had all my mail there. And it just made me so angry because it reminded me that I never had privacy in that house, not just from Sergio either. You know, when renovations are happening the day after my fire, it's like the contractor has the code to my door when all of my personal belongings are in there. I got a plastic bag for my car and I start putting everything in it because I don't want my name or my bills. And I had a couple of notebooks that I had journaled in. Then I find a notebook that was on the ground, open to a specific page. And on that page was a list. I had made this list months ago and it was everything that I wanted in a house because I didn't feel safe in that house. And I really wanted a house that I felt safe in. This is the crazy thing, is that house fire, it was traumatic. I'm not going to deny that. But that's where people stepped in and actually restored my faith in humanity. The majority of what I experienced for 2 years from the time Sergio was arrested and throughout the whole legal process was horrible. Besides for a couple of friends and their support that are out of state and a good neighbor. Other than that, it just felt like everything was taken from me, even financially. With this fire, all of a sudden, people stepped in. A case manager with Red Cross was there by 5 a.m. at my neighbor's house and gave the kids backpacks with stuff in it, hygiene products for each one of us, a whole packet with information and a debit card to use whatever way I wanted to, except for cigarettes and alcohol. It could be used for the hotel or gas or whatever. So I was able to get a hotel because of that debit card. One of my friends here in town, she immediately came to my neighbor's house and then took me shopping and spent a ton of money on clothing for me and my kids. My next door neighbor immediately came. She was like, tell me what you need. Claire, of course, immediately sent me money through, I think it was Venmo, and then created the GoFundMe and shared it multiple times. People donated clothing. Oh my gosh, my kids' friends donated their clothes. When I experience these things, I realize there are good people that actually help and give with no strings attached, which has been rare for me to experience. It moved us out of Lynchburg, which is what I wanted.
It healed her heart a little bit to see that there are still people in the world that are good.
Here's Claire.
Because she really did have so many people, complete strangers, come around her and support her and donate. And as terrible as it was, they are now living somewhere else, which I think is super important. They were kind of like the silver linings in the storm.
Do you worry for her safety now that he's out?
Honestly, yes. Does it scare me? Am I fearful? Absolutely. Which is terrible, especially because I'm so far away. But she's so brave. And she has made some changes in her life that have made her more safe. And so that makes me really happy. I would love nothing more than for her to leave the state. But just with her kids in school and everything right now and sharing custody with her ex, that's not really an option.
What do you hope for her for the future?
I just hope that she can find as much healing as she possibly can. And I hope that she can find a full sense of safety, a true supporting group of friends in that area, because I don't feel like she has that. I pray peace over the rest of her life and no more trauma. The fact that she's still such an incredible, loving person, despite everything that's happened, is just such a testament to who she is and her character.
Thank you for being such an incredible friend to her. I'm so thankful that she had your support through all of this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. This was like such a Twilight Zone moment for me. I introduced her to your podcast. It's funny because I sent her the podcast and I said, listen to Sarah's story. You're going to be blown away because it reminded me so much of her and her ex-husband. And I was like, you need to go on her podcast for everything that's happened with your ex-husband. The fact that she's had two things in her life happen that could have landed her on this podcast is wild to me. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I know that you truly care about the people that you talk to, and I know that you really care about telling their story.
That means a lot. Thank you so much. It's truly an honor. Is there anything specific that you would like listeners to keep in mind when listening to Marie's story?
Keep in mind that she did make every effort to reconcile the issue, to get Thomas Road, their leadership in particular, to take it seriously. And it just fell on deaf ears for the most part.
Here's Marie's brother.
She had done everything in her power to resolve it for her family's safety. And that has always been of first importance to her.
What do you hope for Marie's future?
For her to do well and maintain the relationship she has with her kids, but maybe spend more time with the rest of her family from time to time, because she does live far from pretty much anyone.
How safe do you feel today now that he's out?
I feel safe because of me. I had a shift in my mentality because for a long time I didn't feel safe, but I focus now on my ability to keep me and my children safe. I think this experience changed me for the better. It definitely made me stronger because I gained more and more confidence in myself. One thing that changed significantly during this process was my ability to depend on everything I have internally, unlearning things that I had learned that drove my beliefs and behavior, really restoring my identity. Because even though Sergio had been arrested, even though I didn't see him for like 6 years, I finally, in the past couple of years, recognized slowly the effects his abuse and actually my ex-husband and a lot of people, the effects that they had on my identity. So there's kind of been a restoration, I guess, of my identity of who I'm supposed to be. And I'm feeling more comfortable with me as I learn more about me. Another thing is this experience made me more aware of patterns and of boundaries and how systems work. One thing that's changed also is being more intentional about who I let in my life. Where I wasn't very intentional before, I'm extremely intentional now. A lot of times it's lonely, but it's safer and it's more peaceful.
What do you want people to understand about stalking? Or what do you feel like people misunderstand about stalking victims and what they experience?
Stalking doesn't usually start in a very expected or obvious way. It can start as just a friendly encounter and then a friendship and then harassment, but it does build up. And I think it's important to recognize the earlier signs. I'll keep going back to boundary violations. I think that is literally the starting point. Another thing is stalking is not just one extreme behavior. It's not just one incident. It's a pattern that escalates over time. Another misconception, I think, that's very common is that people who are stalked are afraid for their life and in fear of death or harm. I don't think that's always the case. In fact, from people I've talked to and what I've heard and what I've experienced, people might not actually be that afraid, which is why there's a lot of people that don't get protective orders. Sometimes it takes a while for us to recognize the danger and to be afraid. So I think it's important. We shouldn't judge a victim's safety based on how the victim is acting. We should judge a victim's safety based on the behavior of the predator. I would also say that stalking is psychological. So does harassment, but especially when the stalking is by someone you trusted or a friend or a family member or a person in a position of authority, it is so confusing. It really had a psychological impact. And I started questioning my own reality and my sense of safety. So even though there were times I felt like I was in danger, I would change my own reality and talk myself out of it and say, no, I knew him for years and he was always a good person. One thing that really helped me was doing my research. And it's so unfortunate because I didn't have time for that, but I made time for it. Find other victims that have been through the court process. Document and journal, because there are times if things happen and you're like, that doesn't feel right, you can go back to the journal, find a way to build confidence. We're valuable enough to fight for ourselves and defend ourselves and get justice. My belief in justice and the way I view justice comes from my faith more than the legal system. I think that there's justice, even though I can't fully see it yet. And I don't feel that complete justice was served through the legal process. But I recognize the fact that there was any sentencing for a pastor of Thomas Road Baptist Church in Lynchburg, Virginia, I think is very significant. The fact that he received jail time and it was some type of accountability, which now I know is rare in this community, that is significant. So even though it's not complete justice, there are significant achievements that were made, progress maybe, in this town. When I look at the influence involved and the resistance I encountered throughout the whole legal process and the number of people I was up against, it's unbelievable. So that is really what I focus on. It definitely wasn't enough because it didn't feel like full accountability. My faith tells me that the story isn't over just because the court cases.
Absolutely. And justice means something so different to everyone.
It really does.
Throughout this season, both with your story and with the other stories we're covering, one of the themes is friendship betrayal, people crossing those boundaries. I'm curious for you what feels unique or nuanced about being betrayed by a friend or a pastor versus like a romantic partner.
There is a difference because with friendship betrayal, especially in a situation like this with Sergio's betrayal, he and other people came into my life after my divorce in a position to support me. So there is a level of trust, which is what made it even harder to recognize. With a romantic partner or a spouse, it's different when you live with them every day. They kind of have more control psychologically. With friendship, like Sergio, I would see him and know something's not right, but then a few weeks would go by. I would get into my head, it wasn't that bad, and I would just ignore it. And then he comes back in, and that's normal friendship. We don't see them every single day. That kind of made it different and very challenging. Friendship betrayal adds a lot of confusion. There's a deep betrayal when someone that you didn't have a romantic connection to deliberately come into your life and betray you. It almost feels more predatory.
I feel like it's almost like in dating, you're expecting to get hurt. And I guess in friendship, or especially a relationship with like a pastor or church member, it seems like to me it would be more surprising.
That is such a good point, because who goes into friendships expecting it might not work out or expecting that we're going to be hurt or betrayed? Especially with Sergio's wife, she was in a position of trust. Why would I not trust a pastor's wife? On top of that, she's a woman. She's a mother. Her showing up to support him in the court and her testimony, which is shocking and very disturbing. The betrayal isn't just to me as a friend, but like as a woman and as a mother. I don't understand how she can be a mother and have complete disregard for the fact that he was in my daughter's bedroom, even more as a pastor's wife. How can you claim to love God, know God, and as a Christian, you're supposed to abide by God's word and see the situation and see what your husband has done and see the harm that's been done to me and my children? The narrative that she's giving to people, I can only assume that what she said in court under oath is what she's actually telling people and more. It's just betrayal after betrayal. So if you can imagine one friend betraying you and how harmful that is, now imagine being betrayed over and over and over again by people that say they support you, have convinced you that they're here to support you, that have convinced you that they're going to advocate for you. That's still betrayal, even if the relationship wasn't super close.
We can't thank you enough for being willing to share your story. The fact that you've been willing to continually speak out despite all of the challenges that you've been navigating over the last few years. It's not lost on me how much you have given and worked to speak out and to advocate for yourself and other stalking victims.
I really appreciate that you gave me and other victims a platform. Telling my story has been part of my healing.
Thank you so much to Marie, Claire, and Brendan for their time and energy in this chapter. We are deeply grateful for their advocacy. Chapter 2 will begin airing July 30th. In Chapter 2, we'll meet survivors Summer and Daniel. What began as an ordinary college friendship quickly unraveled into a web of deception, manipulation, and escalating behavior that left an entire community questioning what was real. Alongside friends and professors, Summer and Daniel slowly uncovered a pattern of lies so elaborate it was almost impossible to believe. But as the truth emerged, the consequences became impossible to ignore. In the meantime, we have some fantastic expert interviews with Dr. Marissa G. Franco and Dr. Becca Schwartz-Mehta on their research related to friendships, the importance of belonging, and the trauma and recovery from friendship betrayal. Thank you so much, as always, for listening.
Thank you endlessly to every survivor, guest, and expert who has contributed to our community. We are eternally grateful for your bravery, energy, and time. Something Was Wrong is a Broken Cycle Media production created and produced by Tiffany Reese. Thank you to our incredible team. Associate producer Amy B. Chesler, audio engineer Becca High, and social media marketing manager Lauren Barkman. Special thanks to Sarah Stewart for our amazing season 26 artwork, Stephen Wack for ad audio editing, and our partners at Audio Boom. If you love Something Was Wrong and you want to help support the show and listen ad-free, become a community contributor on Apple Podcasts or purchase a sticker from our sticker shop at BrokenCycleMedia.com. Or tell everyone you know, like your neighbor, sister, brother, yoga instructor, florist, telemarketer, Reiki healer, stylist, trainer, mentor, parents, cousins, aunties, unks, coaches, librarians, matcha artist, dance instructor, balloon artist, wedding planner, bridesmaids, bank teller, driver, dog groomer, dentist, orthodontist, esthetician, tattoo artist, house cleaner, accountant, tax preparer, insurance agent, mail carrier, crossing guard, barista, beekeeper, notary public, lifeguard, camp counselor, flight attendant, dog walker, pet sitter, Pilates instructor, spin instructor, tarot reader, acupuncturist, landscaper, electrician, plumber, contractor, real estate agent, mortgage broker, optometrist, veterinarian, park ranger, farmer's market vendor, little league coach, PTA president, school librarian, substitute teacher, driving instructor, wedding officiant, travel agent, locksmith, Ferris wheel operator, hot air balloon pilot, llama farmer, falconer, puppeteer, professional mermaid, or that one friend who's somehow just in everyone's business. If you know, you know. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, stay safe, friends.
Hi, friends. This is Amy B. Chesler. And if you've been loving listening to Something Was Wrong, you'll definitely want to check out Broken Cycle Media's sister podcast, What Came Next. With more than 170 episodes available, the series explores what happens after survivors share their stories publicly, diving into healing, justice, advocacy, and the lasting impact of trauma and media exposure. Co-created and co-produced by Tiffany Reese, the show gives survivors a platform to discuss not just what happened, but where life led them next. Follow and listen to What Came Next wherever you get your podcasts.